Welcome to Hedge Interview. This episode is part of the Investor Views series, which features family office investors from around the world. My goal is to shed light on the unique insights and perspectives from this important niche of institutional investors. My guest today is Nitin Shakhter. He is the founder and CEO at the Green Capital Family Office, which is based in Delhi and manages approximately $300 million. Nitin has extensive experience as an institutional investor and thought leader. He is a frequent panelist, moderator, speaker, and contributor to editorial syndicates where he shares his views on multi-asset class investments, asset allocation, trends, capital markets, and early stage growth businesses in emerging markets. Thank you for joining me today, Nitin.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer, and thank you to the viewers for hedge fund interviews as well.
First, tell us about the Green Capital Family Office and your firm's primary areas of investment interest or focus.
So essentially, the Green Capital Single Family Office started in Delhi in India in 1985. So over the last 35 years, we've built substantial asset bases in India, Asia, and globally as well. And we invest across asset classes. The initial capital started from real estate. And now we ventured into public equities, private equities, venture capital, bonds, and about 70% of our assets are in India and about 30% globally in UK, US, Eurozone, and some parts of Southeast Asia. Essentially, as a single family office and asset proprietary investor, I am the third generation of the family office. And I have about 20 years of investing experience, seen different cycles. And now we are in the process to get more globally aligned and allocate more resources globally as well as we speak.
And so would you be increasing that percentage of your, you're looking to increase the global percentage of your family office portfolio?
Correct. We'll probably reduce the percentage at home and we'll probably increase the percentage in maybe developed economies in France, Germany, or UK.
And how has the coronavirus affected your approach to investing?
Well, we got a great opportunity to invest, if that's what you were asking, where asset prices were down 40-45%, which happens probably once in 10 years. The last time this happened in 2008, and then we went into a 10-year asset class appreciation cycle. So I think what tends to happen is it throws up a lot of opportunities. So if you have cash on hand, it's a great opportunity to invest. Of course, it has its cons in a sense that travel and certain industries like airlines, hotels, hospitalities, and tourism is hit, and they probably take a lot more time to recover. Mm-hmm. And we sort of brought that to how the financial industry recovered and substantially took almost 1.5 to 2 years to even recover. So I think this time this industry is going to take a lot more time to recover as well. And of course, deal making goes a bit slower because due diligence on physical assets reduces because of no travel. Right. But I think we're okay. We are not in a hurry.
That's good. And how do you typically source new investment opportunities?
It depends on the asset class, right? So for public equities, we have a research and a trading department. We constantly look at reports, earnings, and what is publicly available in terms of information. For venture capital and for private equity, we already have a pool of investors that we work with and who we have invested with in the past. For obviously for real estate and bonds, we do come across certain trends on the digital platform where we look for substantial regulated responsible deal flow from institutions that we have heard about. And obviously that's predominantly the way that we operate, mostly on a referral network and mostly from existing relationships.
And do you collaborate with other family offices?
Yes, on a case-to-case basis, if the asset strategy, if the understanding of the exit, understanding of the capital meets our same objective, then we'll be happy to collaborate. We have collaborated in the past, but those instances are few and far between, because every family office or every other institutional investor has its own mandates. So we need to see whether those mandates meet our objectives and whether our objectives meet their mandates as well. So that tends to happen, but maybe once or twice a year.
Oh, okay. So I was wondering, when you mentioned referrals, I had heard that often family offices refer deals to each other. So I was wondering if that's where what you meant by referrals, but you have other
referrals as well.
So I understand that family offices can be in various stages of revenue generation or capital preservation, depending on the dynamics of the firm, the AUM, and other factors. And volatility obviously presents tremendous opportunity. How would you describe Green Capital's appetite for risk and volatility? Are there certain types of risks that you're willing to take and ones you're not?
Well, there are two opportunities, right? Without volatility, there is no opportunity. And without risk, also there is no way to get a return, right? So I think you have to embrace risk. Have to have what we have a principle is calculated risk management system. I call it as the CRM system, not in terms of customer relationship management, but calculated risk management system is a point of risk and reward and a point of theory which says wherever a calculated risk needs to be taken, then we should go all in as long as we've covered our downside. And that tends to work very well for us in terms of risk management. Obviously, we don't over-leverage. We are leveraged to the point that we can control it fairly, always on cash, because that's obviously a very good strategy to have as a hedge all the time. So essentially, we are careful, but we, when the risk calls for it and the volatility increases, we step in.
And so what types of investment opportunities are you interested in most right now?
At this point in time, we are interested in a couple of exits, not necessarily a couple of buys. We're looking at certain sell exits from public equity. We're looking for private equity exits that we had done some time back. We're trying to allocate portfolio more towards cash right now, slightly more higher percentage of cash. And we can get out of certain investments which have given us a substantial return over the last 2 or 3 years. So that's currently, we're not looking at aggressive investing. At this point in time, we're looking at again, managing our risk. So this is a point to manage a risk at this point in time.
So that leads into what asset classes or types of investments are you avoiding?
Definitely, we're avoiding Bitcoins overall for sure. We're avoiding over-leveraged, over-expensive equity for sure. We're looking at distressed deals in real estate. We're not avoiding that. We are looking at bonds which are substantially linked to emerging market bonds and give a higher cash value equation of 7-8% barring the currency hedge risk. We are looking substantially at certain assets in the, I would say, the VC space, which are addressing situations and economic situations that have thrown a lot more different strategies on board for businesses as well as for corporates in terms of digitalization of businesses, in terms of new categories, in terms of innovation for food, innovation in health and hygiene, innovation and digitalization of communications.
And you mentioned that you're staying away from Bitcoin. Tell me about your feeling. Some people are really interested, some people are really not. So I find it curious to understand your feeling about it.
We've always considered it to be a trading asset class rather than an investing asset class. It was okay if Bitcoin was at $3,000-$4,000 to a coin and you would invest in it and trade it for some time, but that's fine. But we're not necessarily looking at, I'm not very sure on the adoption of Bitcoin as a currency tool. I'm okay with blockchain as a technology, so we differentiated that part. Blockchain as a technology might be adopted, but I think there's still no real onus on central banks or governments as to how do you create currency and digital currencies, and legalization of that is still in question mark by many countries. So we tend to avoid something which is not really backed and terms of a background of an asset or a liquidity asset, we're not very sure on that. So again, it comes to, boils down to what is the price of the asset? What is the backing of the asset? If Bitcoin was at 4,000, maybe I would have still bought into it, but I wouldn't buy into it at 14, 15, 16,000.
Okay. What types of investments have been best able to weather volatility this year from your perspective?
I think a lot of our investments in information technology, a lot of our investments in pharmaceuticals, a lot of our investments in, I would say, standard food and product companies have really weathered it. We've got good returns on something that we are speaking on. We are invested in Zoom. We started that position in February, March, very early, caught on to the trend. So that's given us a 4x, 5x at this point in time. 5x, actually. So that's working very well for us. I think that's about it. We were heavily on cash exercise before the pandemic hit. Not that we envisaged the pandemic, but we just felt that valuations were expensive and it would make more sense to be on cash in January. Now, of course, we're reaching to a point that we're 70-80% deployed.
And so I'm going to shift gears for a little bit in terms of just talking about relationship development in terms of investing. And so relationship development is an important facet of investing, obviously. How has the process changed for you this year, given the impacts on travel and in-person events and meetings that are usually an integral part of decision-making and meeting people face-to-face?
Well, I think personally, we like to meet people face-to-face. We like to establish physical relationships in terms of sitting across the table, discussing the flow, discussing objectives. There's a lot more difference that we see when we're talking virtually versus when we're talking sitting face to face. So we miss that, and I hope that we can come back to normalcy maybe by next year, February, March. We are okay with virtualization. We adapt it. We embrace it. But I don't think we're going to embrace it for the long run. We'll probably embrace it for another maybe 5 or 6 months. And we've already reduced that exposure. We were heavily into it at calls and webinars and Zoom calls and all that. But sometimes you do face a digital overdose and overlay, and you need to just step back and then reflect on your relationships. We've already built so many. We've initiated some new ones, but we've not really invested very aggressively with any new relationships at the time we were able to meet with them as well.
Are you finding that Zoom and video are able to compensate?
Well, it is what it is at this point in time. We have no other option to do this, right?
Right.
And that's what we are also doing. Otherwise, we would have preferred me to sit across a desk and talk about things, right? If I was in New York or wherever. But I don't think this is going to be sustainable in the long run. I think people are essentially social lubricant, and humans thrive on social interactions, relationships. Investment industry also does the same. And I think people are just on a wait and watch and probably looking at the next 5 or 6 months. I'm quite hopeful that interactions should start by February, March.
I sure hope so. Have you attended virtual events? And I don't mean like this one-on-one, which is pretty simple, but events that where they were formerly conferences with multiple attendees. Have you attended those kind of events? I haven't. I wonder how they work. That's why I'm, if that even works right now, or if people are just waiting for those events to be normal again.
I've done, I would say, about 10 to 12 events where I've been on panel discussions virtually. We've done conference calls, we've done Zoom calls, we've had meetings, we've discussed deals. We've done a fair number of snapshots. I've got interviewed virtually as well. So I would say that we've done 10, 15 interactions, 15, 20 interactions over the last 6 or 7 months. But the question is that, are these interactions helpful? Do they achieve an objective? Are they the long run? I mean, of course, it's arrangements that everyone seems to be comfortable with. But I would honestly think that if I were to do a conference, it'd be just more fun, exciting, and more I would say noteworthy if it was done in the physical aspect of the world and an offline aspect of the world rather than the online aspect of the world.
Absolutely, I agree. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the day that we can all meet in person again.
Because there's also so much that you see when you sit across a person when you meet, then you can actually discover the flavor of the person, the personality, the objective. It makes a difference.
Absolutely. And does that impact your, you know, decision making as far, does it make it take longer for you to decide on investing when you're not able to assess those personal qualities in people? Or do you feel that you just have to make certain decisions in the absence of that element, the personal element?
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, it does make a difference in the sense that the decision making is a bit different, takes longer. You take more value inputs, you have constant calls. The same thing that I could have finished in a half an hour meeting will probably take me 2 or 3 virtual calls to do. So it does take more time. Because in a physical meeting, you can really close down on situations and express what your viewpoints are. And virtualization also has its own limits, right? In terms of timings and in terms of schedules. But a physical meeting is always more preferable, and the closure is faster for sure. And the trust factor is higher. Mm-hmm. And I think that those are the two main important aspects that we vis-a-vis an offline versus an online meet that we've sort of experienced. But you know, the investments go on, life carries on, deal flow happens. Nothing right. Really stops.
And so what advice would you share with capital seekers such as asset hedge fund managers and entrepreneurs who are hoping to attract the attention of institutional investors like yourself? What helps in this environment?
I think definitely a cold call and a cold reach out does not help. And a lot of people make that mistake. They think that everyone is just waiting there to see their proposal, but that's not true. It's the same way that nobody really cares about what investing we do beyond a point. You know, it's very inclusive in that sense. So we need to understand that everyone's time is limited. Everyone is busy with their own office, business, or investing work. How do you reach out? I've realized that the best opportunities are that what we've seeked out, rather than what has seeked us out. Maybe it is a performance, maybe it's a referral, maybe it's something that we have come across as part of our research and we have proactively started initiating that. And wherever people have approached us and it meets our mandate, I think people forget that we should build a relationship first and then talk about deal flow and investing. They start the process of the deal flow, the deal on the table first. But I'm not interested in that first. I would like to know the background, the person, the objectives, build a relationship, have a referral going, you know, have some time spent. It will not happen automatically. It takes time. So even if I see a deal flow from somebody, it takes time for us to take a decision on that, to build a relationship. So, you know, it's a good, and most people don't have patience. They just give you 1 or 2 mails, 1 or 2 calls, but that's about it. Very few people have persistence.
I've heard that time and time again from family office investors that relationship building is really very important, and that capital seekers need to understand that part of the process, and that you just can't rush any kind of deal. So my last question is, now that we're at year end, what are you looking forward to next year?
Well, I'm looking forward to travel being opening up for sure for next year. I'm looking forward to those wonderful destinations of London, New York, France and Germany to come over across. I have to meet. We've put in a lot of seeds and a lot of people have initiated dialogues with us. We need to fructify those seeds into flowers. We need to look at the deal flow. We need to now start investing actively once it opens out. Of course, we continue to invest in digital assets like public equities that does not require a physical presence. But definitely on ground due diligence needs to carry on. And we need to meet people and also come out of our reflections and our refreshment zones and recharged ourselves, because we've been in a zone of 7-8 months where we've hardly traveled. I've only done one trip to Dubai, and we were traveling maybe twice or thrice in a month. So, you know, it's a change and we need to restart it. Investing is carrying on. What I'm referring to is the relationship building that needs to start ASAP. That's what we're looking forward to. And for example, we're looking forward for a vaccine, we're looking for a cure, and we're looking forward for international travel to start, because without that, there's something missing.
Yes, we're all sort of penned in right now. It'll be an exciting time when those things develop. I totally agree. So thank you so much for your time today, Nitin. I really appreciate your insights and everything you've said is very valuable and much appreciated. So thank you again for taking the time today.